Health and Human Services to order. A couple housekeeping measures. Members, you have a letter at your desk from Joe Ario, Administrator, Department of Consumer and Business Services, relative to House Bill 2021 that we passed out Monday. I have informed Senator Fisher that there are some concerns from this perspective, and they will deal with that in the Senate. We are not bringing it back. And Sandy has an announcement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members.
Good morning.
Just want to let you know that Committee Services is having a bake sale out front, and because it's happening during our time at the meeting, we have some coffee cake to go with our coffee this morning. And the bake sale is, you know, for the governor's food drive.
And I sampled it to make sure it was sufficient quality for the committee, and it is, so help yourself. You know, I thought I'd be the guinea pig. And also, next Friday, you'll notice we are not having a meeting because who's using the room?
The YMCA boys and girls, or youth and government, are here for 3 days, and they're really looking for hearing rooms so that they can do their...
And we tried to readjust, couldn't, and we just decided to let them have the room, and so we will not be meeting next Friday.
The 21st, okay. February 21st.
Not this Friday, but next Friday. Okay. Okay, I'm going to open an informational meeting. Today is Rural Health Day in the Capitol, and so we thought we might delve into rural health a little bit. And first up, we have Ed Patterson and Don Nyberg, I guess, at the same time. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ed Patterson, and I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. I think it's very fitting on Rural Oregon Day that the Oregon Rural Health Association present a little background information on what has transpired in the past. I also have with me Mr. Don Nyberg, who was an architect and has been a healthcare architect for many years, worked for the state as a regulator and a planner for health planning for, 25 or 30 years, Don? And you'll recall that last session, or part of last session, the summer of 2000, Mr. Chair, you and Senator Fisher led a little delegation of rural health, or health committee, joint committee, on a tour of the rural parts of the state. And I followed along in my car behind, of course, didn't get to ride in the vans, but we made several stops and visited rural hospitals, rural health clinics, and a number of rural emergency medical services providers. I think it was a very enlightening trip for a lot of the members who had not been to rural Oregon and looked at the health situation. As a result of that, House Bill 2515 was introduced by yourself, as I recall, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Because one of the things that you found on that tour was that in Oregon, at least most of the hospitals, or more than half of the hospitals in the state, are rural. They're under 50 beds in size. Most of them, if not all of them, were constructed with either loans or grants from the Federal Hill-Burton Act that was enacted after World War II, when there was a big public policy that maybe we don't have enough hospitals in this country. And the feds provided sizable amounts of money to assist rural communities in building new hospitals, and many communities that didn't have hospitals. And so most of the hospitals in the state, rural hospitals at least, were created with some Hill-Burton grant money and loan money. And that, the downside of that is that they're mostly about 50 years old now. Most have not had good economic times in rural Oregon. The facilities themselves need improvements. And one of the things that 2515 called for was the appropriation of some $15 million to address that issue.
And colleagues, you have a copy of that bill in your packet.
But a funny thing happened on the way to the bank, and those funds were reduced in the second special session. They were cut in half to help balance the state budget, reduced to $7.5 million, and then in the fifth special session, it was reduced to $3.75 million. And that money has not been appropriated, not been released, it's been frozen. So our grandiose desires in passage of 2515 has not come to reality. But we were fortunate enough to land a $60,000 grant to begin at least the process that we were going to do anyway had we received the funds from the National Rural Health Association. And we received a $60,000 grant, and the goal was to solicit from the rural hospitals, and there's 31 in the state, solicit those desiring to have an architectural assessment of their facility as a beginning point to see what the needs were from a physical plant standpoint. So we recruited Mr. Nyberg to come out of retirement and perform those assessments. And what we'd like to do is to share those assessments with you, at least partially. We had enough money to fund 12 of the assessments. 8 are complete. I think Mr. Nyberg has actually done 10 of them, but only 8 have the complete reports in. And I asked him to be here and kind of give you a bird's eye view of what the committee saw, but a more in-depth view of what the needs are. And I think he's done a commendable job for a relatively little amount of money. And I know that some of the hospitals I've heard from have been pleasantly, I shouldn't say pleasantly surprised, but were pleased to have him there to make those assessments and have awakened some of the thought processes in the rural areas among hospital board members. Having said that, we made a decision not to reveal the identity of the community where these hospitals are at this juncture. We have asked them if it would be in their best interest could we reveal those, but the reports themselves are not identified with community hospitals. At some point in time, we may be able to do that once we get the releases. But I asked Don to be here to share with you what some of those needs are, and at least the beginning of maybe a policy discussion about what priorities ought to be in terms of health care, expenditure of health care dollars. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Don, and he came down with a bad sore throat last night. I'm not sure how long he's going to continue with his presentation, but I ask him to share with you some of the findings that he has made in his 10 separate trips to rural Oregon.
Okay. Thank you. Chair, Representative Cruz, members of the committee, I'd first like to just give you a brief overview how this was done and based on what standards. I utilized the construction guidelines or regulations of our health services division for new construction and alteration of hospitals, which is a standard not expected of pre-existing hospitals, but it provides us a good measurement tool. So as a hospital's compliance begins to fall away from 100%, indicates a higher need for modernization. Also, I utilized National Fire Protection Association standards, which Medicare mandates for construction, and NFPA 99, which deals with emergency power systems and medical gas and vacuum systems and so on. The first area of review was really structural and fire and life safety. Interestingly, I found few problems in that area that were major. None of the buildings were of incorrect construction type, and although there were some safety violations, these were all being corrected at the time. And I believe that's a result of ongoing routine inspections by the Office of State Fire Marshal and in two instances the Joint Commission on Accreditation. I didn't do any detailed seismic review, but I did note the number of stories and some basic features of the building and the seismic zone in which the hospital was located. And interestingly, some of the older facilities are in seismic zone 4 of the central and southern Oregon coast, which is the highest risk and built before modern seismic standards were in place. I did a cursory review of mechanical and electrical systems, including their heating and ventilating system, medical gas vacuum, normal and emergency power systems, nurse call and communication, and so on. And this was an area that was commonly deficient. There were only 2 hospitals out of the 10 so far that did not have major problems in this area. The kinds of things you typically found were lack of proper air distribution, air filtration, and improper pressure air pressure relationships between departments. And this is important for infection control reasons as well as for patient comfort. Corroded and otherwise failing plumbing lines and valves in the older building wings, asbestos insulation, inadequate electrical distribution, and their emergency power systems in several cases were not code compliant because they're not divided up into critical life safety and equipment branches as required by the code, which minimizes the risk of failure. Medical gases, in one case, for example, the lines had all been soldered with lead-based solder, which isn't allowed any longer. I don't know if it ever was, but the system wouldn't test out and couldn't be certified. I did a cursory review of ADA standards and found that common problems here in most of the hospitals with their older building wings that were constructed prior to ADA requirements, particularly patient rooms and toilet rooms where you can't expand the size of the toilet room because you take the space then out of the adjacent patient room and there's already no room to work with. Did a fairly complete review of inpatient care units, again comparing them to the construction standards of the Health Services Division, and averaged about 70% compliance rating overall, but considerable difference between hospitals, with one scoring only 45% for patient rooms and then 50% on all the support features of the nursing units like nurses' station, clean and soiled utility rooms, medication areas, and so on. A second only scored 51% and 42% respectively, and another 50 and only 38%. Poor physical arrangement for efficient staffing was found in, I believe, four hospitals where their OB department is separate from medical and surgical. And, of course, in a small hospital, the number of mothers and infants at one time is usually few, if any. So that means if they have one mother and infant in the department, they have to call in staff and staff that OB department around the clock separately from medical and surgical. And while it's important to keep mothers and infants away from sick people in the hospital, it is possible to staff them from one nursing center. I did a fairly thorough review of major departments, and I believe the average compliance rating to current standards would have something under 70%, 66.8%, again with substantial differences depending on the hospital. In general, I would say, in my own recommendation would be that five of those hospitals need basic replacement. Three or four of them probably replacement on a new site because of property limitations and in some cases topography problems that make it difficult to replace on that site. I thought it kind of interesting that the core area of many of these hospitals, being 50 years and in many cases or more old, tend to be the core basic area of the hospital, with additions having been built off of that. So not the best long-range development method, because you're really limiting the life of those additions to the original core facility. That probably happened because of limited funds and trying to meet needs, not necessarily the best long-range approach. Good long-range development planning is lacking in most of those facilities. One facility had done an excellent job, Most of the rest have done some planning, but it points out the need that good long-range planning is definitely a need, and I don't know what can be done to help them in that area, but that's a need as well as just direct construction. Are there any questions?
Questions?
Yeah, Representative Pearson.
What would be the average cost for a 50-bed hospital to be replaced per bed or...
It's a little difficult to say because in small hospitals you tend to have a high number of square feet overall per bed, so the kinds of figures that you'd normally see from publications don't necessarily apply. Typically, hospital construction is about $200 a square foot in that ballpark right now. Square feet per bed might be in the neighborhood of 800 to 1,000 square feet per bed. But that's
considering everything.
Everything considered, all departments, everything considered.
50,000 square feet.
Yeah. I believe the new hospital down in Bandon was somewhere around $3.5 or $4 million, which is probably one of the smallest hospitals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably Ed. Are all of these not-for-profit hospitals?
They are either not-for-profit, 501c3 not-for-profit, or they are district health districts, so they have a tax base of some kind.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A follow-up? Then the funding for them, do many of them have foundations? Where does their funding come from?
Well, most of for capital improvement funding is usually through a bond sale. And, of course, you have to satisfy all the bonding requirements in order to get a rating or to sell the bonds. The problem that we have found is that they have very little excess cash flow. Some are running in the red every other year, and they're just not very profitable for the most part. And so it's hard for them to have access to capital to do the kinds of major renovation and replacement that's necessary. One of the things that we intended to look at, if we ever get a base of funding, is to see if there are other options available. One of the goals that we had was to apply the dollars that were in 2515 and see if we could leverage that money for additional funds, both federal funds and maybe private funds, and set up a trust that we can have assist the hospitals in obtaining funding for major construction. I would guess that the 12 that Don has surveyed are probably the most needy and probably the ones that have the least access to capital. So the next phase of this would be to develop a financial profile of those hospitals and to go to the bond experts and see exactly what it would take. But the way Hill Burton worked would be traditionally back in the late 40s and early 50s was they would provide a grant to do the long-range planning that Don's talking about needs to be done by these hospitals. And some of that's fairly expensive, $200,000 or $300,000. And, of course, they don't have the kind of money to do that. So if we could provide funding to do that kind of thing, we'd have a basis for going to the bond market or maybe applying for federal grants. We just haven't done that because we haven't had the financing to justify doing it.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. Then one other question. It seems we don't have funds at this point in time in the state of Oregon. With the Fed, from the feds, since they can print money, are there any options, like the Hill Burton was way back when? I mean, can't we get some money from them?
Well, I believe that there possibly are funds available, especially if we designate the funds for the long-range planning aspect of it. But I don't think, as an example, if you had to replace 12 hospitals at $5 million apiece, I do not believe those kind of funds are available. So it would be a cooperative effort, I think, both with private funding sources and potential federal grants that might be available. But I think we need to look at them as a class of hospitals. As an example, Representative Anderson asked a question about square footage. There's a new federal designation called the critical access hospitals, and there's some restriction on the size of those hospitals. I think the maximum is 12 beds, and there's certain other restrictions, but it guarantees them cost-based reimbursement for Medicare patients. And that is very potentially has a lot of revenue, potential revenue, more revenue than what they're making now with non-cost-based reimbursement. So there are many different things. As an example, if you had a model critical access hospital that all 12 could theoretically use the basis for new construction, you may be able to reduce construction costs if you had a certain model that would be a critical access model. And that's just a dream. You have to do a lot of work and a lot of studies, but I think there are ways to assist these hospitals and avoid another real potential crisis for Oregon. But it takes some basic source of funds to do all that kind of work and get the expertise that you need to develop that kind of a plan. So potentially, yes, the short answer.
Follow-up question. Is there any move that you know of on Capitol Hill toward reinstituting a Halliburton type of funding?
Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, you're going to have testimony, I think, following us that are much more knowledgeable about what's going on back in D.C. Karen Whitaker is the director of the Office of Rural Health here, and stays in touch with all those people on national level through the National Rural Health Association. She's the one you should ask that question. I think she would have a much more of an insight than I do. In closing, Mr. Chair, on the last page there's a matrix of these hospitals, and by comparison show what they look like, and you can just about tell by the kind of work that Don has done, the ones that probably are the most needy just by this small survey that he has done. And in the way of explanation, there's a rural hospital. For those of you who are new to the process, there are two types of rural hospitals, type A and type B hospitals. The type A hospital is more than 30 miles from the next nearest hospital. The type B is closer than 30 miles. There are 11 type A's and 20 type B's in the state. So about half, we're going to survey about almost half of the hospitals. And I think if I and Don probably could give a better handle on this, but I would say up to half of those 31 rural hospitals have some type of need for long-range planning if you're going to solve the problems they're going to have. Otherwise, we're going to have a major crisis in rural Oregon. The other thing I'd like to hand out, I'll give this to staff, but this is an article that was put in the Oregon Business Magazine about the condition of rural health, and it's really a very good article. It's about 12, 14 months old now, but it tells a lot of the things that the chair and other members who went on that tour of rural Oregon, what they found. And it deals with rural hospitals and answers some questions about the potential crisis out there, rural health clinics, and emergency medical services that have also a big need in rural Oregon. That concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair.
And I'd also like to point out, committee and Representative Mona Sanderson, you were talking about federal funds to do this. We had the federal funds to do this. It was called Medicaid upper payment limits, and which it was designed specifically from the federal government for rural health care. And we took in the third special session, I believe. We took like $146 million of that and put it into education. So that's one of the reasons we're unable to do this at this point in time. And also keep in mind that the $15 million, when it was assigned to this account, it was... We didn't get them to sign it in blood, but the governor agreed to it and everybody agreed to it, and it was a done deal. And we've seen it not only slowly bleed away, but even with this new administration, we haven't seen the release of the funds that are left. So, and we're hoping at some point in time that will happen. Clearly, if the new governor is concerned about rural Oregon, as he says he is, this is something he should do. That was a little editorial. I hope it's okay. We worked hard. We gave a lot on this during the last session, and it kind of irks me that we have sunk in the funding to the level we had, because we had identified the need, and the need is acute. And the $15 million was basically a minimal amount to allow us to start addressing some of the infrastructure needs. And now it's down to 3.75 and still not available. So,
Mr. Chair, I might add that I was told just the other day that there was over $300 million in MUPL funds, which is all federal money, $300 million in this biennium, and there were over 100 different priorities that were funded out of that.
Hmm. And we aren't going to go into all of that. That would take the rest of the day. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Kathy and Ruth.
Martha, can you dim the lights and bring the screen up for us? Thank you.
Kathy here and Ruth there.
Yes, for the record, my name is Kathy Britton. I am the chair of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council Healthcare Committee and also the president of the Oregon Telehealth Alliance. I am going to move quickly to the demonstration because I'm very grateful to see that the docs are still there. They have patients waiting their services, and they have very graciously agreed to do this demonstration for you today. One of the things that I know that you all received last week when we testified in front of you was packets on telemedicine. And this will be an actual telemedicine demonstration. It's a cardiac demonstration, so you don't have to worry about seeing any gross or ugly things that we often do to people when we're doing demonstrations. And at this point, I will refrain from any further comments until after the demonstration is over so that we can let the docs that are on both ends get back to their patients. I'm going to turn this over to Ruth Giesking, who is the telemedicine director at St. Charles in Bend. You're looking at a split screen that has the Burns Hospital on the left-hand side and the St. Charles Hospital on the right-hand side. And Ruth is at St. Charles, and I'm going to turn it over to her right now.
Morning, Ruth.
Good morning. Thank you. We have Dr. Bruce Brundage and his patient, Mr. Van Cleve in Burns, and then Mr. Solis here in Bend. And I'm going to turn it right over to Dr. Brundage, who's going to show you what telemedicine is all about.
Well, thank you, Ruth. I'm Bruce Brundage. I'm a cardiologist. My practice is in Bend, Oregon. But once a month, I come to Burns to see patients. And so this opportunity came to demonstrate the telemedicine equipment. It's a little bit backwards in that normally as the consultant in cardiology, I would be the one who would be sitting where Tom is in Bend, and a nurse or a family practitioner would be sitting here with Mr. Van Cleve, who is my patient, and I would have my interview from Bend to Burns by teleconferencing here, and then we would go through a physical exam, which I'll demonstrate to you briefly, which would be carried out by the nurse or family practitioner under my guidance while I can listen in Bend. And if everything works right, you'll also be able to hear what I'm hearing here and what I would hear in Bend as well. So with that way of an introduction, let me just start my interview with Mr. Van Cleve, which will be brief, and then we'll do a brief examination to demonstrate some of the telemedicine equipment. So, Mr. Van Cleve, first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to participate in this, and we got up early this morning, so we'll be sure that everything is working right, so he's been sitting here patiently for a while. But now, Mr. Van Cleve is a 59-year-old man who has high cholesterol, which we call hypercholesterolemia. We know from some fast CT scans of the heart that he has a fair amount of plaque in his coronary arteries, and he also has high blood pressure. I saw him a year ago, February of 2002, after he had his first fast heart scan, and we recommended that you increase your Mevacor, which I believe was done. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I see from the laboratory data that the cholesterol is down to 163 now, triglycerides 45, HDL's grade at 63. And the good news is we finally got your LDL down under 100. It's 89. Last year it was about 100. I had wrote it down here. It was between 105 and 115. That's why we wanted to increase the Nevacor. So any problems with increasing the Nevacor relation? Mm-hmm. And then in your continue to feel well, have no problems. How's your blood pressure been?
Good.
Good. So you're still on a basal check for your blood pressure?
Yes.
Right. And you had another EBT scan, is that correct?
Yes.
In November.
November of 2002.
Right, which was 1 year, and your first one was November of 2001, so 1 year apart. And Ruth, can you put up the EBT scan so people can see what I'd be looking at?
Sure.
Let me try to put that up on the screen here. There it is. This is, and can you forward single frame that, Ruth? Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Good. Right, stop. Can you go back one? Probably can't go back one. Yeah, you can. Go,
yep.
Go back one more. Keep going. Right there. Stop right there.
Oh.
Now you see the little white spot there at about 3 o'clock on the image. Well, it was on the image there. And that's where the plaque was that we saw in 2001. And your score then was 104. We repeated it in a year later, so now it's 144. And that was about a 30% increase. But the good news is we actually look at the volume. That is how much area the calcium takes up, which is actually the volume of the plaque. And it was 91 in 2001, and now it's 95. So there's a very little change in the volume. So that means to me that all you've done is it's got the scarring is just got a little more dense, but the plaque has gotten no bigger. And that's good. That's good. And that's, I think, because we've got the LDL cholesterol now under we're under good control to that target. And I would suspect that in the future we would see very little change either in the volume or this. This will probably not harden much more than it has right now. So that's good news that we've gotten those things under good control. So the next thing I would do would be want to have a physical exam. As I said, I'm actually physically here. Tom is in Bend. I would be in Bend, and Tom or someone like him would be here and under my direction would use the equipment so I could actually see and hear the physical exam. So let's move that. We have a temporary exam table here in the area. If you could just take your shirt off. I don't think you need to lay on those things.
Just take your shirt off.
Just get your shirt off.
Where's the privacy on this?
he signed a consent. We made sure.
He signed a consent. He's a good guy.
I'm not embarrassed by any
of you. We actually have somebody who's in good physical shape, so it was nice to now we have a stethoscope that is an electronic stethoscope.
You guys can move your camera just a bit. We can't see you or him. So can you move your camera over just a bit? Perfect.
There we go.
Well, we have an electronic stethoscope here. And you hear me tapping it, and so I know that it's on. And now what I can do with a person who has a little bit of feedback here.
Yeah, your hand over it.
Over there.
There you
go.
What I would do is what we call a cardiovascular exam. It actually examines blood vessels as well as the heart and the lungs. So an important area to listen is over the carotid arteries, the arteries going to the brain, to see if there's any buildup of plaque.
You're hearing this through a microphone. Dr. Solis is actually here.
And there's no noise there, so that means the carotid arteries are. I'm going to listen to long. Deep breath. Camera that allows us to look at a variety of things we might be interested in. And somebody with high cholesterol. How do I do? I have to.
You can zoom in and out of that.
But I'm not seeing anything.
Oh, you want to see?
Yeah, I need to see so I know what I'm showing them.
And then you may have to white balance it to get a true picture of the skin.
There you go.
No, I want to see the picture. There. Okay. This is what I would see in Ben. And people who have high cholesterol may develop little bumps on their skin here and here and along the elbow. See the elbow there called xanthomas? He doesn't have any, but I would want to look for that. And so I would have the nurse or doctor on this end show me those areas there, and turn your head that way. And another thing that we're interested in is the neck veins, and I actually can see the neck veins there, and I see that they fill when I put my finger, and that they empty normally. So he has a very normal cardiovascular exam, and he's doing well, and will be continued on his current regimen of medication, and we're finished with our exam, Ruth. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Cleve and Dr. Brundage.
You're welcome.
Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions?
Great.
No, it amazing demonstration, and I couldn't diagnose anything personally from what I saw. But we want to thank you all very much. We've heard about this, and it's really great to be able to actually see a demonstration of how it works.
Great. Well, you're welcome.
Very welcome.
You're certainly welcome.
Thank you, Ruth, and Dr. Soltis and everyone who participated, especially you, Mr. Van Cleve. That was a really nice thing to do for everyone. One of the things that we want to stress is that the use of telehealth or telemedicine allows us to keep people in their home, to keep the patient in the local hospital, and not have to transport them unless it's necessary to do a more sophisticated procedure. this is very important to the economy of the rural hospital. It's also very important to the well-being of the people that we serve. So we appreciate the opportunity to show you this. We appreciate the opportunity to let you know more about telehealth and how it can be used in the rural areas. So thank you very much. If you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer them. And we also, again, thank you for your DuPass recommendation on the telehealth reimbursement.
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, how many centers like this do you have around the what cities are accessed?
Chairman Cruz, Representative Anderson, we do not, unlike a lot of states, have a centralized telehealth hub or telemedicine hub with spokes going out to other hospitals. But what we do have is a very vibrant growth of organizations who are installing the infrastructure so that they can reach many of their rural constituents. Right now, St. Charles reaches out to Burns, Lakeview, John Day, Redmond, Prineville. I can't remember, but they have several rural hospitals that are expanding. Peace Health in Eugene is reaching out to its rural constituents. Asante Health Systems in Grants Pass is reaching out. We have OHSU, who is doing a lot of rural work in Eastern Oregon. We have Legacy Systems, we have Samaritan Systems, we have Adventist Systems. All of them are beginning to put telehealth into place, and the primary beneficiaries of those systems are their rural constituencies. So it's a vibrant, growing effort. We also have many mental health providers using the system to access not only just general psychiatry but specialized psychiatry. So there's a lot of growth in Oregon, and we're real excited about it. Removing the reimbursement barrier is going to be a major push towards getting it going. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sharon, Rural Health 101. That's all there is to that?
We're trying to so that I can use my overheads. And I apologize for the condition of my handouts. I spilled half a cup of coffee into my briefcase this morning as I was coming down the back steps, and I didn't have time to get them recoffeed. So there are some spots on them, but I don't think it obscures any of the actual overhead. So
it looks fine.
For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Office of Rural Health at Oregon Health and Science University, and my job this morning is to just do a kind of a brief overview of some of the issues involved in rural health care. And the first issue is generally what is rural. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that this morning because I suspect that you know that, but there are people who spend their whole lives studying what is rural, and there are enough books written about it to fill this room. So we're not going to get into that. I'm just going to talk with you about what the definition of rural is that we use in the Office of Rural Health, because there are a number of state benefits that accrue to rural practitioners and rural hospitals. It's important to have a pretty precise definition. What we use is a geographic area 10 or more miles from a population center of 30,000 or more, and we also look at some degrees of rurality. I wonder if I can...
So basically, by that definition, you leave the Willamette Valley, there are basically only two places that would qualify as urban, and that's Medford and Bend.
Well, here's a map, and there's a map that doesn't show up very well that's in your handout. So Mr. Chair, basically you're right. We have Portland, we have Salem, Eugene, and Medford and Bend. Yeah. And the rest of the state, about 91% of the land area of the state, we regard as rural.
Just wanted to make that point.
the data that I'm going to share with you today, and this is a lot of statistics, and so I hope I don't bore you with it, but the data I'm going to share with you this morning is organized in this way. And it looks at frontier counties, which are the 10 most rural counties. They have fewer than 6 people per square mile. As a matter of fact, many of them have less than 1 person per square mile. Counties that are exclusively rural, where every community in the county meets that definition. There are a number of counties with mixed urban and rural populations, like Lane County, Jackson County, so on. And then the one urban county in the state is Multnomah County. That's the only county in the state that has nothing in it that qualifies as a rural community. And this is how that works out in terms of the actual state. All the dark blue area is frontier. The green area is rural. The orange area is mixed urban and rural. And you can't see, but you know where Multnomah County is right up there at the top. It's in red. So basically, I think it's important to examine why we even look at rural health as a separate issue from urban health. And there are 4 characteristics of healthcare in rural areas that differentiate it from healthcare in urban areas. Those things include challenging demographics, health status disparities, workforce maldistribution, and the vulnerable infrastructure of the healthcare systems in rural communities. One of the most startling, one of the starkest demographic differences has to do with the age distribution in rural communities. As we look at frontier, rural, mixed, and urban counties, the frontier counties have slightly more than 16% of their population over 65. And then this is a very linear relationship right down to the urban county, which has about 12% of its population over 65. The percent of population over 65, of course, is a pretty good indication of what kind of demands you're going to have on your healthcare system. This one is even a little bit more startling. This is unemployment rates by county type for the year 2000, for the whole year. The frontier areas, of course, are much higher than the rest of the state. Some of the frontier counties have double-digit unemployment and have had double-digit unemployment all through the 1990s up until the present time. The boom that took place statewide didn't really affect some of the most rural counties. They didn't participate in that. So the unemployment rate is high. That, of course, leads to a lot of people who don't have health insurance as well. And as you'd expect, the median income, it follows right along. The lowest median income is in the frontier and then followed by the rural counties of the state. If we look at health status measures, I've picked out 2 for us to look at today. There are a number we could look at, but I think this one is really interesting, and it's death rates from unintended injuries. That is a euphemism for accident. I don't know why they can't just say accident, but no one intends to have an injury, unless it's a homicide, I suppose, so or attempted one. So these are death rates per 100,000 people, and they're very high in the frontier areas, and there are a number of reasons for that. Has to do with the availability of emergency medical services. Also has to do almost surely with the type of occupations and the dangerous nature of some of the occupations in rural parts of the state. The other one I've chosen to look at here is tobacco-related deaths, and this is a pretty marked difference as you go from the most rural to the least rural parts of the state, where a little over a quarter of all the deaths in the year 2000 in the frontier communities were related to tobacco use, and less than 20% in Multnomah County. The next issue.
Yes. Have there been theories on that? Is that people in the frontier regions, rural regions, are really healthier healthier people? I mean, in a sense, there's more diseases in the urban, so that sort of dilutes the number of tobacco-related
people. Representative Monis-Anderson, that's an interesting question. I don't think it has been examined. I know that tobacco use is higher, and people who use tobacco in these more rural counties also smoke more. So that's going to be a direct correlation with the numbers of deaths. But the issue that you raise is an interesting one, and I don't think it's been investigated. It'd be worth looking at. The numbers, the workforce in rural communities is, as you would expect, also a considerable challenge. We're looking here just at physicians, and Dr. John Saltz, who's going to follow me, is going to talk about workforce issues, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but here is the ratio of physicians to population for those four types of counties, and of course the higher you go, the fewer physicians there are. All the way down to Multnomah County, where if you're in a room full of 200 people, one of them is likely to be a physician. In Frontier counties, the ratio exceeds 1,200 to 1, and in fact, in some counties of the state, the most medically underserved county in the state is one you would not expect. It's Columbia County, which is just adjacent to Multnomah County, and that ratio is about 3,200 to 1, and most likely is a result of the closure of their hospital in 1990. About two-thirds of the physicians in the county left after the hospital closed, and they have not returned. The SHEP Center, which is a rural health research center at the University of North Carolina, published a report on rural physicians and really just confirmed what we already knew, and that is that non-metro physicians work longer hours and earn less than their urban counterparts, that they get a higher percent of their revenue from Medicaid and Medicare, and of course those don't pay as well, and that they are more productive than their urban counterparts. So when we go to recruit a physician to a rural community, it's a pretty hard sell, because we say, here you go, you're going to work more, you're going to earn less, and you're going to work harder, and you're not going to make very much money. And so it's amazing that we're able to recruit any at all, but fortunately we are. And Dr. Saltz is going to talk with you about some of the characteristics of rural physicians. It's also worth looking at the infrastructure in rural communities, and here are where Oregon's rural hospitals are located. I'm sorry, that is not very clear. The autofocus isn't autofocusing. I'm not sure why. But we do have about 30 hospitals in rural communities. They're classified in three different classifications, actually. They're either a type A rural hospital, which is more than 30 miles from another hospital, or a type B, which is within 30 miles. They all have less than 50 beds. And then there's a special category called critical access hospital that is a federal category. There are 14 or 15 critical access hospitals right now. One of them is sort of in transition, about to be certified. They have fewer than 15 beds.
Which one's that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. I think Scott Ekblad, who's going to follow me in a bit, can probably tell you exactly which ones they are. But we do our survey and then look at the application, then we send it on to Seattle, and then they're the ones that make the final determination. If we look at the occupancy rate of Oregon's hospitals, and that's going to, of course, be directly related to the income that they bring in, the very small hospitals in frontier areas have a fewer than 20% occupancy rate. In fact, the hospital up in Heppner's average occupancy rate is less than one person per day. And so it's pretty hard to generate enough revenue to pay their overhead when their occupancy rates are so low. That's generally due to the fact that they're in a very sparsely populated area. And that doesn't mean they don't need a hospital there. It just means that there just aren't enough people to keep it full all the time. And, of course, up to about 60%, close to 60% occupancy rate in urban communities. And that rate has actually, I think, gotten higher since I looked at these data. I know the hospital at OHSU is nearly full a good part of the time, is up to 95% occupancy, and often has to divert patients. If we look at percent of Medicaid discharges in Oregon hospitals, they are much higher in the frontier and the rural areas, about 13% in urban, 12.7% in urban, almost 19% in the rural counties, and down to about 13% in the frontier counties. And then,
yes, Representative.
What do you mean discharges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this are the insurance status of patients as they're discharged. So this would be individual patients. If you look at patient days as opposed to discharges, sometimes it's a different statistic. For example, with Medicare, there will be a higher percentage of patient days than there are discharges because they have a longer patient stay. But I've chosen, just as a matter of standardization, to look just at discharges, which are individual patients.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. About 47% of the discharges in Frontier hospitals, down to only 21.4% of the discharges in urban hospitals, are Medicare patients. And I'm sure you have been educated to the fact that Medicare and Medicaid both pay less to the hospitals than private insurance does. And then here's the combination of the two, about 60% combination Medicare and Medicaid in Frontier hospitals, down to 34% in the urban hospital. Another important provider of health care in rural areas is the safety net clinic, and these are rural health clinics and federally qualified health centers, and these are the locations of those types of clinics throughout Oregon. In very rural Oregon, there are few federally qualified health centers. They get a federal grant and a federal subsidy. There are more rural health clinics that are very small and are often staffed by nurse practitioners or physician assistants. This is, a federal designation. A few years ago, the Oregon Primary Care Association did a report of rural health clinics and found that their average operating margin was about minus 30%. And that...
Representative Morris Anderson.
Can you explain what that means, the average operating margin?
Yes, Representative Cruz, Representative Morris Anderson. The operating margin is just a simple division of how much money they bring in compared to what their expenses are. So their expenses are outweighing the patient revenue by about 30%. Some of them have additional revenues. Some of them have some tax money. They have a tax base because they're in a tax district. And they can bring their average total margin up to about almost 3% on an average. But 60% report the negative operating margin, and 40% report a negative overall margin. And this report concluded that 46% of the clinics were at risk or vulnerable and about to close. So the summary of these issues is that we have unfavorable demographics. We have some unfavorable health status measures. We're not sure why in some cases, but we know that statistically that's the way they report. There are certainly some workforce issues that Dr. Saltz is going to explore in greater detail. The hospitals are fragile. The clinics are vulnerable. And, of course, the resources are diminishing to take care of those problems. Oregon is unique in that for more than a decade, we've paid some very special attention to rural health care and have done a real good job of passing legislation that would benefit rural practitioners and rural hospitals. Our situation would likely be worse if it weren't for those programs. In Oregon, the rural practitioners get a personal income tax credit of $5,000. And we were the first state to pass a law like that, and we're the only one that administers it in exactly the same way. There are four or five others patients, but they have some strings attached. We have an Area Health Education Centers program that Dr. Saltz is going to talk about some more that focuses on training practitioners in rural areas so that they will stay there. Our AB and critical access hospitals have cost-based Medicaid reimbursement. The critical access hospitals also have cost-based Medicare reimbursement, and we do have some funds available for rural emergency medical services, and Scott Ekblad from our office is going to talk with you some more about those.
Question.
Yes.
You said 46%, I think, two slides before are at risk of closing. And I'd sort of like to get from Ed, we were looking at long-range planning for some of these rural hospitals. Are they included, the ones that we want to enhance and get better? Many of those, you're not in your head, yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mont, yes, they are. Some of these clinics, however, are in communities where there are no hospitals. You know, they're in very remote rural communities. I just gave you the good news. Before I stop, I want to give you the bad news. And that, was there another question?
Thank you. Just a quick question. Could you define cost-based Medicaid reimbursements?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, cost-based Medicaid reimbursement is based on a cost report that the hospital files, and it basically says that they're getting paid for the cost of providing the care. And in many cases, on a what they call a DRG basis, they get paid less than the cost of providing the care.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What is a DRG basis?
Oh, I'm sorry. This we could talk all day about how hospitals are reimbursed, and I probably couldn't even give you all the information that you need. A DRG is called a diagnosis-related group, and it is a prospective way of reimbursing a hospital. It means that if you have a patient who has pneumonia, for example, you're going to get a set amount of money to take care of that patient regardless of how intense or acute the condition is or how long the patient stays in the hospital. So you get an upfront amount of money, a set amount, to take care of that patient, as opposed to the cost-based reimbursement where you get paid according to the amount of resources that you expend to take care of that patient.
One final follow-up. But they're actually getting paid for, reimbursed for the cost of providing the service, what they deem the cost to be, as opposed to, you know, a percentage of what that cost might be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, yes, they are right now. As of March 1st, that's the bad news part. They won't be getting paid for that cost any longer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That OMAP has had to publish a notice as of last Friday saying that on March 1st they're going to desist paying cost-based reimbursement to the rural hospitals.
Well, and I would say that we're somewhat amazed by the fact that they think they can do that administratively and override what the legislature has done, and in fact we have a bill in our committee that would do exactly what OMAP is now saying they're going to do, because I'm refusing to hear the bill. So I think we may have a discussion on this next week. Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't ask you earlier. When we were going along on the income, it showed, and I know it was lower on the frontier, it was $30,000 was the median income. That seems awful high to me. Is that because you have a few people with tons of money out there and most of them not? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I wish I could give you better information on how median income is calculated. I suppose it's calculated, it's different from per capita income in that it looks at actual people who are earning money rather than the entire population. So I think that's probably why it comes out a little bit higher than what you would expect.
Thank you.
The final little bit of bad news that I want to share with you here is that the funds for emergency medical services that Scott Ekblad and Greg Lander are going to talk to you about are also threatened by Senate Bill 5513, which would eliminate those funds, and also that those funds are not in the governor's budget as well. So I wanted to share that with you, too. I know that there's not a lot of good news floating around the Capitol right now, and I wish I could be a little more optimistic. But that's pretty much the overview that I have. I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you have.
Any other questions? Thank you, Karen.
Okay, the person who's following me is Dr. John Saltz. He's the chair of family medicine at OHSU and the head of the Area Health Education Centers program and a real expert on rural workforce. Thank you.
Come on up. Good morning, Doctor. How are you doing?
Good morning, Chairman Cruz, members of the committee. I'm flattered to be called a real expert. We don't want to have any fake ones today. my name is John Saltz. I am a professor in the School of Medicine at Oregon Health and Science University and the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine there. I've been in Oregon for 16 years working at OHSU. And a big part of my job is training physicians and other health professionals to practice in rural communities. For the last 8 years, I have been the director of the Oregon Statewide Area Health Education Centers program, or AHEC. AHEC is a program that's included within the OHSU budget, and it's really a program designed to make connections between the university's academic programs and the communities that are the constituents served by our graduates. AHEC has four regional centers. Each of these centers are independent, non-for-profit corporate entities. They're located in LeGrand, Bend, Corvallis, and Roseburg. And those four centers geographically represent our state, with boards of directors that are representative of the counties within those regions. AHEC's budget, 70% of the money is distributed to those centers, and the centers' principal role are to define and articulate the needs of communities within that region and partner with OHSU to develop programs to address and meet those needs. This is a successful program that has been present in the majority of the states in the United States. It's originally funded by a federal grant in 1988-89. Over the period of time that AHEC has existed, we've brought about $15 million of federal grant money, just the AHEC grants themselves, not including the other foundation and federal grants that we've written for projects that we've done. And AHEC has also been funded by an appropriation from the state that's part of the university's budget that funds the base operating cost of those community centers. So I'm here to talk with you today about what some of the challenges we face with workforce needs for doctors, nurses, dentists, other health professionals in rural communities. To tell you a little bit about some of the work we've done to address those problems, I have for you a collection of reports, which I will leave with your committee. I can get more copies of these reports if you'd like. But about 3 years ago, AHEC received a generous grant from the Northwest Health Foundation, and we did a survey of several health professions, including physicians, primary care physicians in particular, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, registered nurses, dental hygienists, dentists, and pharmacists. And we did a pretty thorough and I think methodologically sound survey of those providers and have produced reports, one on each of those professions, regarding where Oregon's health workforce works and what their attitudes are, what their age is, what their future plans might be. This is excellent resource material. What's even better is that we have all of this data in a database in our office. So if you have questions that come up in looking at this material, we're a really good group to ask because we actually have some facts on which to base. I'm sure many people come before your committee talking about what there's a shortage of or what there's a need for. And sometimes it's really hard to base that information on facts. I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we are currently doing, and then spend the majority of my time addressing questions that you have for me, because sometimes it's a challenge to try to guess what you're really most interested in knowing. During my tenure at OHSU and with the AHEC program, we've developed a bunch of programs to address specifically getting physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, and nurses into rural communities. In my own department of family medicine, we currently require all of the residents in the program to do 2 months of rural training in either John Day or Enterprise. The School of Medicine's curriculum has been evolved to where every medical student that graduates from the School of Medicine has a 6-week experience in a rural community, working with a rural physician, living in that community with the travel and housing costs paid for by the AHEC program in partnership with the local community that's hosting the student. We have a rural residency program in Klamath Falls, the Cascades East Family Practice Residency, that's been operating since 1995 and produces 6 rural physicians per year. And thus far, the program has an admirable track record at the number of those folks who are staying in Oregon and practicing, particularly in the eastern half of our state. We are now developing a rural practice-based research network to study the health problems that exist in rural communities and how to make rural doctors and hospitals and nurses more effective there. The AHEC program has developed a whole range of programs focused at junior high school and high school children, because the making of a health professional begins a long time before they go to medical school or nursing school. They have to have adequate preparation in the public schools, and they have to have a sense that their dreams to be a doctor or a dentist can come true. One of the things we know about recruiting rural health professionals is that kids who grow up in rural communities are most likely to return there. So we put a special effort in recruiting kids from rural backgrounds and kids from underrepresented minority groups into health professions, which continues to be a challenge to try to diversify the health workforce in our state. So I think there's been a lot of things that we've done. I think we're pretty proud of some of the results that we've gotten. The university has become nationally known now for its primary care programs and its rural health programs in particular. I think OHSU is ranked 11th in the country by U.S. News and World Report for its rural health programs. It's ranked 3rd in the country for its family medicine department and 2nd in the country as a primary care medical school. Of course, being the chair of family medicine, I'm proud about that. But it helps us to recruit people into our programs at OHSU that are interested in this area. They come to our school in part because they're interested in that and in the benefits of living in our state. So I think what I'd like to do is stop and maybe address some of the questions you've got. I do think that we're now facing some pretty unprecedented serious problems with recruiting a rural workforce. Karen has showed you some interesting information, demographic information. But the fact of the matter is that we've seen nationally a significant downturn in the percent of graduating medical students who are interested in primary care careers. The rural health system is very dependent on generalist providers. And that may not be a term you're familiar with, but by a generalist provider, I mean a doctor who can take care of most things. Family doctors take care of people from all age groups and with all different types of problems. General surgeons are the generalist within the surgical field. They operate on a broad range of things that they can do. And in fact, the rural health system traditionally has been composed of family doctors, general surgeons, and some sort of mental health provider, whether that's a counseling social worker or a psychiatrist. That's usually been the sort of core foundation of it. As we have more difficulty recruiting people into generalist programs because medicine gets more and more complex, the advantages of narrowing your practice to just one type of medicine, both financially and intellectually, that's a very powerful force to fight against. But you can't really be a doctor who just takes care of one organ system in a place like Burns, because there's not enough people there to support somebody who just takes care of one organ system. So The challenge of training generalists is an added problem to the economic problems facing rural communities. And I'm concerned that as the population continues to age, we're going to have increasing difficulty having successful medical practices and successful hospitals in those communities. So maybe I'll stop and see where you'd like me to go with the rest of my comments.
Clearly one of the directions we can go to address that is expanding the scope of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, kind of filling the gap. And I think especially with the telemedicine now ramping up, I think that's going to enhance that a lot. It clearly kind of a stopgap, but maybe the best we can do at this point in time.
I think we have here in Oregon over the last 6 or 8 years started a physician, actually two physician assistant programs now, one at OHSU and one out in Forest Grove at Pacific University. And I do think physician assistants are a big part of how to expand and enhance the workforce there. We have a long-standing tradition in our state of a very advanced Nurse Practice Act, and we produce a lot of nurse practitioners here. But remember, to be a nurse practitioner, one has to be first an RN. And we have such a workforce crisis in the RN workforce that each nurse practitioner we make is somebody we're taking out of the RN workforce. And that isn't often talked about, but we really have pipeline problems in nursing in some ways that are worse than in medicine. Finally, I think one of the challenges here is to figure out what kind of health system we really think our people need. If you're living in Burns, there are problems that you might develop that really are going to require specialized care that would be hard to have in Burns. But the more we make the healthcare system in Burns rudimentary in terms of its capabilities, the more at risk you are if you have an auto accident or a serious on-the-job accident, or if you have a heart attack in that town. It's a different matter how helpful a cardiologist can be who's someplace else. So I do think we should not aim low with the quality of health care for rural Oregonians. I think that we should plan a health care system for them that's based on all of the best parts of medicine. I think telemedicine can absolutely leverage a very specialized health care system into an environment where generalist providers are needed, and I think you saw a good example of that, how that can be done today.
Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First, on the nurse practitioners, we have noticed a very, very effective rural health clinic in Rogue River, and they've trained, I believe, two nurse practitioners are helping to train. What's the ability to attract nurses? Are you having success? I heard what you said about drawing them out of the RN population, but is there a real move in that direction that you're filling?
Well, there's a real move in the direction of trying to increase the number of registered nurses that are produced. There are a lot of people more expert than I am about that. I can tell you that the problems are very serious with recruiting people into nursing. And they're much more serious than just what the pay level is or the average age of nurses. For example, 50% of the medical students at OHSU today are women. A generation ago, those were women who would have likely entered nursing or teaching as professions, and today, those women are entering medicine and law with earning potentials that are substantially higher than what they can get in nursing. Nursing hasn't succeeded as of yet in making itself appealing to men. And so they have a problem with the whole pipeline. Now, OHSU, I think, is really proud of what we've done with nursing education. We've regionalized this process, including the OIT and Southern Oregon and Eastern Oregon campuses. I think in many ways we have a terrific national reputation as being sort of idea leaders in this area. But that doesn't mean that we don't have nearly all of the communities in our state right now struggling to attract attract the number of nurses they need for their hospitals to be successful. And of course, the nurse practitioner workforce is part of that question. So I think we're going to see a lot more physician assistants and nurse practitioners working in the primary care setting. But as the population ages, it's a question of, can we really have a physicianless system in rural Oregon, one without physicians? I just don't see that as likely playing very well with the older population, because the statistics are those people are really looking for care from physicians, and the difficulty is then they travel to other places, and it further can deteriorate what goes on. So I think there has to be some planning about what we really think the right provider mix and skill mix for people in places like Burns or Lakeview might be.
Follow-up on that is on the dental hygiene population. Are you working with industry and the dental industry to... It's difficult to train a hygienist without all of the equipment for a dental office. And I understand DynCorp and Willamette Dental are talking about opening their facilities. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, you're just a tiny bit, Representative Anderson, just a bit out of my area of expertise now in terms of dentists. I can tell you we have a workforce study on dental hygienists that we did. I think most of that training does in fact happen in dentist offices. There are a lot of dentists in practice who partner with these training programs and have trainees. It's a wonderful way for the trainees to get real world training, and it's a wonderful way for the dental office to identify future employees. We've had success with this preceptor model in the community with medical students and nursing and nurse practitioner students, PA students as well. We do an awful lot of our education in community settings.
Representative Morris Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Anderson's question regarding nursing shortage, Senator Nelson and I are working on a nursing shortage bill that involves the community colleges and OHSU, and we even have the hospital representation at the table and Oregon Nurses Association. And there are what this will do is increase the infrastructure with the distance learning, as well as simulation laboratories, mm-hmm. where you can actually train more students. Right now you have to have a one instructor to eight students. And with simulation labs, you can maybe hopefully increase one instructor to 16 students. Because when you talk to the various nursing programs, there are people who are not getting into the nursing programs. I mean, OHSU, what, only has slots for 88 or 100, and there were 300 that applied. So we have to be addressing, and the same for community colleges, addressing that, and that's what we're hoping to do with this bill. So that's what we're working on. And I don't know how I hadn't thought about AHEC and funding from AHEC that could help this project also.
Well, Representative Mona Sanderson, Chairman Cruz, I really think it's important that you're supporting that bill and have been helpful in crafting it. This is a very important workforce need for those communities. The hospitals are dependent on the nursing workforce, and the care of patients really depends on a healthcare team, not on individuals. We should be really proud in Oregon of the system we have for producing nurses. We've done some amazingly innovative things here. The RFD training program that has allowed nurses to get distance education in really small communities like John Day has been a national model. Now that program has been cut back some since because of funding problems, but I think we've been very much at the forefront in innovation at training people, and some of that has come from the fact that we have a statewide scope to how our nursing education programs work together with one another. So I think it's very important that this is being addressed, and I thank you for your support of doing that. I think OHSU has obviously put a lot of thought in how we might organize this effort best, and we appreciate all the assistance we're getting in that effort.
Got one other question.
Okay.
Yeah. Where does the funding for AHEC come from? Where does it come from?
AHEC was, I'll tell you briefly, about its funding history. The first dollars appropriated to AHEC were in the 1989 biennium and were a small amount of startup dollars appropriated by the state legislature using lottery funds directly to the AHEC program. As we began to get federal grants, the federal grant program is designed to fund each of these centers for 6 years, at which time the center goes off of base federal grant funding. You can apply for much smaller grants for special projects after that. So between 1990 and 1997 or 1998, we cycled a total of 5 centers into existence with federal money. We have for the last several biennium been receiving a state appropriation that was moved out of the lottery and into the general fund and included within the public corporation appropriation for OHSU starting in 1995 when we became a public corporation. So AHEC now gets an appropriation of about $3 million a biennium that has been part of OHSU's appropriation. It's within the OHSU appropriation amount now. In the last session, we closed the Columbia Willamette Center, which represented the Portland metro area, focusing the program now mostly on rural communities. So we have 4 centers remaining at this point. But the funding, the state dollars that have been invested in these centers, it's a $250,000 per year per center budget, which if you roll that up times 4 centers times 2 years with then some programmatic support at the university that pays some of the infrastructure costs for the rural training that the students do. We have leveraged that with a very substantial amount of grant funds. For example, all these reports were generated by grants from the Northwest Health Foundation, so the base appropriation, and then the federal grant brings in about another $100,000 a year to each center that that we've gotten.
So the $3 million that our general fund puts into AHEC leverages then how many millions of dollars federal money?
I can answer that question. Looked at over the history of the program, $3 million a year has probably brought in about $15.5 or $16 million of federal money. Looked at on an annual basis, the budget is $1.5 million per year, and we probably bring in just under $1 million in grants that is in addition to that. Okay?
Representative Barker?
Thank you. Chair, I just a couple comments on the distance learning. By the way, your school does enjoy an excellent reputation both with the docs and the nurses. I know as far as training centers, and I have a niece who's applying to training as a nurse. In the distance learning, I talked to Portland Community College, and in their 2-year program, one of the things they said they were starting to find, although we're cutting their funds, that they can get people in their rural areas who are in their 30s who want to become nurses, go back to school. And then they want to stay in those areas, and they find that to be very, you know, really a good program. And it sounds great to me. And now here we are. I mean, here we are facing more budget cuts, and I wonder if you're experiencing the same kind of experiences. And then as kind of a follow-up too, I noticed that Providence just started a program with the University of Portland, where they will pay for 4 years of college if somebody agrees to stay out with them for 3 more years. And I hope that program's successfully filling up. It doesn't seem like there's a lack of nurse applicants as much as there's a lack of training rooms or training spaces for them.
Yeah, I think part of it, Representative Barker, members of the committee, part of this relates to the cost of the education, it relates to the infrastructure that's required to do the training, and it relates to the work environment that people work in. I can tell you from the point of view of the medical school, we have, because I'm a lot more familiar with the medical school applicant pool since that's my primary job space, nationally, there has been a 35% decrease in the number of applicants to schools of medicine in the United States. At OHSU, we have had a 35% increase in the number of our applicants over the last 3 years. And we're increasingly witnessing large numbers of people who want to be here because of the school's reputation and because of the location that we're in. Now, this increase is happening even though we currently have the second highest tuition of any publicly supported school of medicine in the country. I think that that's the types of out-of-state applicants we get, that's not a big deterrent to. The types of in-state applicants we get, it may very well be. But it's resulting in an increasing debt load for people graduating from those programs. And of course, that then drives how they make career decisions in some ways about where they're likely to practice. In the case of rural practice, we know that the pay rate is lower and the work hours are longer. In spite of the fact that we have a lot of people coming here because they're interested in that sort of practice, it's a challenge to retain them. We had a grant from the federal government at AHEC about 5 or 6 years ago that was a community scholarship program for doctors and nurses and PAs. It was for each of the major health professions. And any community that wanted to put up some money to pay for a kid from their community to go to one of these schools, the grant would match that amount. That grant is now expired. Some years, there weren't any communities that took advantage of that. And, of course, part of it was trying to figure out how to get information out to them about that match. And part of it has to do with the degree to which people do or don't want to come back. It is a more non-traditional learner that is wanting to train in the rural setting. Somebody who's a little older and has some work experience, they end up being very good within their profession, but they're not a typical applicant in terms of their academic background. And that requires some flexibility on the part of the academic program as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again. I'll leave these for you.
Okay, who else we got? Mr. Landers, I believe you're up. Is that Karen? Is that this is next? Or?
Scott.
Okay.
Great.
Oh, great. We met once before. As very very small children, actually.
Just you were a small child.
I was a small child once. It's hard to believe.
Hatch like.
Very special. That slipped out. I should, you know, but it's on the record now, isn't it?
So. Okay.
Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Representative Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Lander. I've held a number of positions in the EMS field, emergency medical services, over the years. Currently, I'm representing Rural Emergency Service Enhancement Fund, which is through the AHEX, and I'm a member of that committee that works on the grants applications that come in. This was some money that was generated from a bill that was introduced in 1999, Senate Bill 911, and it was basically brought about because of a recognized need for EMTs, specifically in the rural communities. As you've heard through a number of people talking before, number of people going out of those rural and frontier areas and no longer available to respond on ambulances or quick response units. A lot of that was because of moving from the rural areas, and we know there's been quite a transition of people from there, but also the aging, and that's been talked to here. And we had a number of people that were out in these rural areas as volunteers working on an ambulance who were 60, 70 years old. Recognizing that wasn't going to last forever, there was a need to, you know, build up those numbers. And a lot of the problems with that was the lack of money. Initial training cost money, and then to continue and have that continuing education to maintain their certification after they get trained was an issue. And because of that, we saw people falling out and not returning. And so money was made available through this fund, through the AHEX on a grant basis. and different areas would put in a grant for the individuals to do their training. Since that's happened, we've had nearly 1,000 people trained, initial training and certification that have gone out there. I'm not here to talk about the overall numbers from the state office, but the numbers generally drop down. There's a two-year recertification period, and it would build up, and then it would drop off, and it would build up, and it would drop off. And since, and due to some degree to this grant, that has started to stabilize out, and the numbers have increased some. Obviously, with those people available out there, we talk about these rural areas and frontier areas, more people available to respond to calls and therefore in a timely manner, because most of them are volunteers, so they get called up. If they're available, they go on the call. Some of the communities, like Gentura, had one or two people available. Well, they're not available all the time. So now that's increased with more people, and they're more available, more of them available and more often available. So we have more people that are certified that are maintaining that certification and be able to provide that care for the sick and injured. If you look at that map that you have there, it's kind of interesting. You kind of think of a rural area as that place out there where we don't go very often, and we're just talking about those people responding to their local constituents. But in fact, that's not really the truth, because people travel all over the place. And as you look through that map, and you talk about some areas out there that there's more white showing than there are roads, even like Ironside, which is number one on your map there, which is a very, very small community, they get 310 vehicles per day coming through their community. And it goes all the way up, and you can follow it down through there. Gentura, which is really out in the middle of nowhere, gets 1,300 vehicles come through a day. Camas Valley, which a lot of people take to go to the coast, 3,500 people per day or vehicles per day come through there. Cave Junction, it's way out there. You don't have many people there, but they respond, and they have 10,500 people per vehicles per day coming through there. Sisters, Wilhelmina, even higher. And kind of direct routes to places, but they're very small communities, and they're the ones that have to respond. So there's a very big need. Most all of these areas have one or two paid people, but mostly all volunteers. Currently, there is a bill that has come forward that is looking to basically take out the money that was appropriated for emergency medical services through the AHEX. And Scott's going to be talking about the Office of Rural Health that also is funded through that. That would make that no longer available. It's a need that has not just been met and then therefore is not going to be a problem anymore. It's a need that has to continue on. True, the money that has been talked to in that bill would go to state police and children abuse, and true, that's a very big need. But the reality is they're taking away the money that supports the people that first see those individuals and can potentially decrease their injury and potential death. So there is a very strong need for sustainability, and through this fund, that has been really helped but needs to continue on. Any questions?
Any questions? Please go ahead.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity for me to talk to you today about emergency medical services grants through the Office of Rural Health. For the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I am the Deputy Director of the State Office of Rural Health, which is located at Oregon Health and Science University. The 1999 Senate Bill 911 created the Emergency Medical Services Enhancement Account from funds in the Criminal Fine and Assessment Public Safety Fund. The Office of Rural Health receives approximately $328,000 per year to award grants to rural EMS providers for equipment and EMS system enhancement. These funds have been distributed statewide, as you can see by the map attached to my testimony. Emergency medical services in rural Oregon are very different than what can be expected in the Portland metro area or any urban area of the state. Services are provided primarily by volunteers in service areas that can exceed 2,000 square miles. Our office conducted a survey of rural Oregon EMS agencies in 2001. The agencies that responded reported that 77.8% of their staff are volunteer, who typically respond from work or home, many miles from the point where they need to report. Many of these agencies, 45% of our survey respondents, are quick response units, which are essentially providers of first aid that are not able to transport a patient. Rather, they attempt to stabilize a patient until an ambulance can get there, sometimes from 100 or more miles away. When survey respondents were asked to list their primary challenges, they were finances, equipment needs, recruitment and retention of personnel, and training of personnel, not necessarily in that order of priority. The Office of Rural Health addresses these equipment needs through the EMS Enhancement Account Grant Program. We accept applications at any time from rural Oregon EMS agencies. If their need is deemed critical, we are able to make a grant award within a week of their request. The majority of applications, however, are reviewed and award recommendations are made on a quarterly basis. We utilize a committee of our office's advisory body, which is the Rural Health Coordinating Council, to evaluate the grant applications. We've received 294 applications since our first round of awards in April of 2000, representing over $5 million in requests. We've only been able to fund just over $1 million, or 20% of the total that's been requested. Our office receives no money for administrative costs to implement this program, with the exception of photocopying and mailing expenses, so nearly all these funds go directly to rural communities. These grant funds have been used to purchase equipment such as automatic external defibrillators, or AEDs, jaws of life, radios and pagers, and even ambulances, repairs and maintenance of emergency vehicles. We once paid for required vaccinations for the volunteers that were staffing an agency, and once purchased insurance for an agency that was just starting. Most of the agencies applying for these funds have nowhere else to go, or if they have, they've been unsuccessful. There just aren't a lot of foundations out there funding EMS-type needs. Less than 1% of the criminal fine and assessment public safety fund is dedicated to rural Oregon EMS. So all of the grant programs that we're talking about here represent less than 1% of that fund, and unfortunately a bill has been proposed this session that would eliminate that fund, and that's Senate Bill 5513. We're all hopeful that you have a chance to weigh in on Senate Bill 5513 and that you will oppose it. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah. I've actually had conversations with the EMS folks in Halfway, so which is about as far east as you can go and still be in the state of Oregon. We talked to a lot of those folks when we were on our tour a couple years ago. So, you know, we're talking about remote folks here. So, any questions? Thank you all very much. We will take all of this into consideration, I hope, as we enter into our deliberations as to where to spend this ungodly amount of money we have.
That's it.
Okay. I'm going to close the informational hearing. Thank everybody for sharing with us, and we are adjourned.